God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. Anyone can use the chat function to send them their phone number to the newcomer privately. David, you seeing any hands up? All right. I will read the preamble, and for kicks, I will go ahead and put that up on the screen as well. AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. But the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. And as a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we will be on steps 8 and 9, are part 2 of that. This is using the paragraph excerpts from the book. And please welcome our panel this evening. We have Lynn and Larry. I will read the first paragraph that starts on is an excerpt from page 80. And then the panelists will each share for a few minutes on each of the readings. And I'll go ahead and put that up. Steps 8 and 9, part 2, section 1, page 80. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, the wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. And Lynn, common practice is is ladies' choice, whether you would like to go first or would like Larry to go first. So it's your time to make that call.
I'm going to let Larry go first on this one.
Cool. Thank you, Lynn. Hey, Larry, alcoholic. I'll get the particulars out of the way. My sobriety date is January 31st, 2017. So we're not too far from it. I have a home group. It's Simple Actions. It's the Candlelight Group in downtown Norfolk, 1301 Collie. We meet Friday at 8 o'clock. I have a service position within that home group. I also have a sponsor. He's aware that he sponsors me. I talk with him regularly. And I do have the privilege of sponsoring other folks and taking them through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the step where I started to feel. I felt like step 5, I had a little bit of freedom, a little bit of something, felt the little tingle. But the 9th step is where it really started to happen for me. I started to feel a significant spiritual experience when I was making these amends. And man, we're hitting it right out the gate, right? The domestic problems. And I had these. I had almost exactly what this paragraph describes. My wife had left me in 2015. I had probably gone through a handful of AA meetings. 2014, she kind of gave me this ultimatum that I needed to get some help. My wife had been sober for a few years prior and said I needed to get some help. And she said I had a problem. And my response was, yes, I do. The problem's you. That's the problem. And if you fix you, then I'll be good. And that, of course, did not occur. And about a year after she gave me that conversation, maybe less than, she left. And during that time, I needed to find the girl that understood. That's what I needed. That's really what I needed. And I did. And I found that woman very quickly, probably in about a week. And the thing about the reason I tell this story is because not only did I impact my marriage, I also impacted this woman's life. In part of once my wife and I reconciled, and I won't get into the details of that, but one of the part of the amends or part of the reconciliation, this was before I got sober, was that I would never talk to this woman again. And of course, this woman comes up on my eighth step because I used her when I was separated from my wife. And, you know, my wife did give me at some point after I made amends, I got sober and I made amends to my wife. She gave me permission to make amends to this woman, which I still have not done. I don't know if it's wise. The next paragraph will go into about, you know, going into the gory details and maybe, you know, we can't sacrifice, you know, our own freedom for someone else's pain. And that's the way it was for me. I'll tell you, because this paragraph is kind of associated with my wife, when I first made amends to my wife, and let me time myself because I can talk for hours on this. When I first made amends to my wife, I was told, fuck you and your fake amends. That's what she said to me. And if I'm being honest, she was dead right. I went into that amends to my wife with an outcome in mind. I thought for certain that I would make this amends and things would be great and we would hug it out and it would be a beautiful thing and she'd forgive me and it would put me back in her good graces. And that's not what happened at all. And I think she kind of read through it when I made that amends. But it did start a process, at least for me. My sponsor was very firm to say, we don't do living amends. We just change our behavior. I was a very non-present husband. So kind of what it described in this paragraph, I actually did. I was the one that was very not present. We're talking for years, for probably a better part of 10 years. My wife raised the children. She really did. I never taught any of my kids how to ride bikes. I very rarely went to their school event. And for the last few years, I was pretty much confined to my room. And I was not a present husband and I wasn't taking part in the marriage. And because of that, we both decided to go our separate ways within the marriage, which, as you may know, I mean, you can read between the lines. We both went our separate ways within the marriage. And it was a, well, I guess, I don't know if that you all read the paragraph or not about this long road of reconstruction ahead, but this, this amends that I made to my wife was the start of that reconstruction. It did not end from me simply uttering the words that I was wrong. I had to change my behavior after that, which I did. And today I try to be a present husband. I try to be a present father. And my wife and I do, we have a probably, I don't say probably, we have a better marriage than we've ever had. We had to one figure out, do we like each other sober? Because that was my drinking buddy. And I wasn't sure if I liked her without alcohol. And she wasn't sure if she liked me. And at first we didn't really like each other, you know? But it's taken some time and it's taken what my sponsor called just changing my behavior. I get to be a husband today. This is not a living amends. This is me doing what I'm supposed to be doing in the first place. So anyways, that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share. I'll let Lynn go.
Hey, everybody. I'm Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. And I wanted to hear Larry first because I wasn't married at the time that that I got sober and because I was the other woman. And I was like thinking to myself, I was going, I don't think I've ever shared this in a mixed meeting. But anyway, just to give the parameters, I mean, I do have a sobriety date, which is May 30th, 1995. And I've had the same sponsor now for the last 25 years. Her name is Michael E. She's in Augusta, Georgia. And I do have a home group and it's a Zoom meeting currently right now, the Mid-Atlantic group that meets on Sunday nights. And I actively sponsor some of the best women in this area. So on the part that we just read, I don't think I've ever shared this in a mixed meeting, but I was the girl, the other girl, the girl who understood, and I was in the process and had been in the process for the better part of about 4 years of breaking up a marriage. And when I related this to my sponsor, she was my very first sponsor who I had for my first year of sobriety. She did this thing Well, she took this huge gulp, and I could tell that what I told her was not cool. You know, like I could see it, like I could see the gulp in her throat, and it was just like, oh my God, what am I going to say to this chick? I don't want her to drink again, but you know, this is not cool. And she said, well, what are you doing right now? And I was like, well, I don't know how to talk to him sober, so I don't know what to do. And she goes, well, okay, leave it at that. You know, just stay there. Just leave him alone. And, you know, that was the best advice that I'd ever gotten, is that you have done enough damage. You know, and I had broken down, not only, I mean, that was in my sex inventory. And it was like, not only it was Bob, you know, and his wife, Deb, and then his two sons, and then, you know, and then all the other people involved from there. And then, you know, it was in the workplace. And I mean, there was just so much damage, that what I needed to do was just cut off any contact whatsoever. And because I had tried a geographic to get sober, I wasn't in the same area. I lived about 600 miles away from Bob. And so the only way to contact him would be on telephone. And, you know, I had the hardest time not picking up his phone calls when he would call. And it was, but I began to feel, it was almost like how many days away from a drink I had been. Like each day, it just got a little bit easier to not pick up that phone when he called, you know. And if they had all this stuff out on the internet, like Facebook and all that kind of stuff, I'm sure I would have participated in stalking. So I don't know how you guys do it in today's world, but I didn't have that available to me then. And so the only way for me to do it would be get in the car and drive 700 miles. And it was pretty inconvenient to do. So, but I tell you what, it was really hard to look at the amount of damage that I had done. And it was there was a huge amount of shame. And when I was a drinking woman, I quite honestly, I was like, I'm not the married one. There's nothing wrong with what I'm doing, you know? And boy, when I got sober, did that change? You know, I became a person who had a conscience and who knew exactly what I had done with. And to this day, I've only had, I can count it on one hand because I can't remember exactly how many times. But over the 26 years that I've been sober, I've had less than 5 conversations with him. And one of them was an amends because I was going up to the area. My sponsor encouraged me, okay, it's been double digits. Maybe now you can contact him if you want to make an amends. And that was it. But the thing is that it was still very, very difficult. It was just because there was just so much shame there. And, but my sponsor pointed out to me in a very, very loving way, and this is my sponsor that's been my sponsor now for 25 years, is she pointed out to me that I had joined a home group that had a lot of married men in it, and that that I had learned how to, in sobriety, hang out with these really good guys who are married men and have solid relationships with them. And I began to practice having solid, good, non-sleazy relationships with good men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is not something, that is not a good reason to go to AA. You know, good reason to go to AA is to get sober. But that's what I learned how to do. And some of these men that I've been in some of them go from my very first home group to today that I've still kept in touch with, and I know their wives, and that I know how to behave well. That behavior disappeared when I got sober. So I'd like to think that process of, you know, being guided through those amends is what, you know, what kept me sober and what allowed me to change my behavior, because I was truly remorseful about it. Anyway, hope that made sense. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lynn. All right, I'll put up the next reading. All right, section 2, page 81. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there would be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" All right, Larry.
Thanks, Mike. Man, this paragraph, it always hits me right here because that is me. I am the inside the China shop. You let me break everything. And I did. I heard a lot of people, especially the people, you know, like I said, my wife kind of raised this. She ran this family while I, you know, the thing is, my wife is also an alcoholic. She drank differently. She was able to sort of maintain the family and drink in these binges, but still maintain the house. And me, man, I'm just gone. I'm just not there at all, not present at all. And I want it to be the cessation of drinking. I want that to be it. All good. We're done. We're all good. Hey, I'm just glad we made it through it. Cool. You're not drinking anymore. All is forgiven. Let's just keep moving. Why worry about the past? Why focus on it? Let's just keep moving. And it wasn't like that at all. Not even close. You know, stopping drinking is a good start. But I, you know, it talks about it in the big book, and the way that I drank is enough to drive anybody crazy. You know, my family is full of early, and especially early sobriety or really early post taking. It happened to me, and it's happened to every guy I've sponsored, every guy I've had the privilege to take the steps. At some point, they come to the conclusion that their family is the problem. They're the problem. Because I'm doing all this work, man. I'm going to all these meetings. I'm taking the steps. I'm calling people. And they still, what's their problem? And that's where I was. It's like, what's going on? And my sponsor was very firm with, actually hurt my feeling about vomiting in his ear about my family. You know, that I need to continue to focus on others because I'm always thinking. But this notion that once I stop drinking, that life will get better. It can, provided I put in some work. You know, last night, I'll just briefly, you know, it's the holidays. I had Christmas with my family, and my brother's been in prison for the past 5 years. This is his first Christmas for an alcohol related thing. And, but I was telling some folks, this is really like the first Christmas I've had with my brother in decades, because often we were there, but we were not there. He was present this Christmas. I was present together, the brothers, because before he went into prison, I wasn't. And prior to that, him and I would take turns ruining Christmas, you know, like who's going to fuck it up this year? That's how we got down. And this year we were both there. We were both present. We were both taking part. And it was an amazing thing. And I have to do that today. My wife has a picture, and when I see it, it still brings me a little bit of pain. It also brings me a little bit of joy. It's this weird dichotomy. And it's a picture of her and my sons at the beach. And they're all kids. They're all like, my sons are grown up. But I look at that picture and I have zero recollection, nothing. I don't remember it. I don't even remember them really looking. And it brings me pain because I missed out because I was too busy doing my own thing. But what I can say today is because of the process of the ninth step and making amends and being a father today, I got to sit on my couch with my three sons and play Monopoly last night on Xbox. All four of us sitting there playing, and which I won, by the way. But so I can't look backwards and dwell on the fact that I did these things and I missed out on their life and I didn't get to all the band competitions and I didn't get all to all the rowing competitions, but I'm able to partake in their life today. And it's really because of what this ninth step brought. And it continues to be a spiritual experience for me every time that I get to be a father, I get to be a son, I get to be a brother, I get to be a husband. That's what it brought back into my life. So that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share. And yes, Len, I get choked up. Lynn likes when I get choked up.
Thanks, Larry. All right, Lynn.
Hey, everybody. Lynn again. Yeah, I like it when Larry cries. You know, you know, the whole scenario of ain't nothing wrong here, Ma, you know, wind ain't blowing, you know, that so totally describes, you know, being a member of my family, because we are not a family, you know, we're a family of six, and five of us out of the six are alcoholics. And, you know, so we're all selfish and self-centered, and we all don't want to talk about it. you know, and on any given incident, like we could say, well, what about the time that, you know, the turkey and the thing happened on Thanksgiving, and we would have five completely different points of view of exactly what happened. Like, there was just so much going on. So as long as we didn't talk about it, there was never a problem. It was like, oh, I was at a blackout, I don't remember that stuff. You know, it was just, you know, not talking about it was just the way to run the family. You know, that was the way of never, ever, like, we don't bring up that, you know, that somebody's hungover, somebody, you know, they go, oh, I have a sinus headache. We just go ahead and go along with it. We don't go, oh, you're hungover. You know, it's none of those things. I mean, we don't call people on anything. And so when I got sober, nobody in my family was speaking to me, and not one person, not one in my family was speaking to me. I got sober a couple of weeks after Mother's Day, and you know, the last conversation I'd had with my mom, she hung up on me on Mother's Day, and because I was pretty drunk, and I had, you know, I'd broken their hearts, but you know, in the alcoholic mind, until you take pen to paper and take this to a sponsor and disclose it to somebody else, you don't see the destruction. I mean, I just thought to myself, I go, well, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Nobody's even talking to me, you know? I mean, that was my whole theory, you know? And the thing is that it would take years and years of, you know, after we started talking to each other again, for, you know, some of these situations to unfold. And what I had in my mind, and this really truly broke my heart, is I had thought through a series of things that I just don't have time to go into tonight, but a series of things that had happened in my family, that I had been disowned because nobody was. And later on, what I discover is that they're not talking to me. My oldest brother, Bubba, he was telling me, he had a very specific conversation with me. He said, no, Lynn, I wasn't talking to you because I disowned you and I didn't want to have anything to do with you. He goes, you were so mad about everything all of the time. I just thought I'd give you a break. You know, I mean, in other words, what he was doing was very loving and compassionate. And what I perceived it is that, you know, that's it. I've been cut off by the family. You know, everybody's disowned me. And it didn't even have anything to do with that. He just said, you were just so angry. I could just hear your anger over the phone all of the time. And I was pissed off all the time. And it didn't matter if I was pissed off at that, you know, anything that was real. Real or fancied, I was pissed off. And when I became, you know, through a series of God coincidences, I got moved back up to Virginia Beach, you know, by the company I was working for. And, you know, I got to be around my family again, and they could tell that I was a changed woman. They were scared of me. And then I later found this app for my youngest brother, Kurt, is he just told me, he just goes, well, he goes, this AA thing seems so weird. You know, I just didn't want to catch it because, you know, I still drink, you know? And I was like, yeah, I know you still drink, you know, I mean, you can't hide that. But it was just all of these misunderstandings. There are a lot of misunderstandings that come from not talking about it and just ignoring it. and just saying, we're never, ever going to have a conversation about this. And one of the really most beautiful things that have happened to me in my sobriety is the mending of the relationships of my family members, is because when you go to them and you make an amends, that's just an opening. Now we can start talking about things. It doesn't mean, okay, I made my amends, check, it's done. It means now the conversations can begin. We can begin talking about misunderstandings that happened years. And I was like 7 or 8 years sober before I ever wrote a check to my oldest brother, Bubba, you know, for you know, something I'd done when I was 16 years old. But it took a while. And it took, and I did it through the guidance of my sponsor. But when I brought this up to my sponsor, she goes, I thought you did that 3 years ago. And I went, no, I was waiting for you to tell me exactly how to do it. So, you know, the first, you know, it may seem like I was pretty slack with my family, the way that I'm describing as far as years of sobriety, but it's very difficult to make an amends to people who will not speak to you or take your phone call. So that's just in, you know, in my defense. And my sponsor had me doing actions, and I don't want to, you know, get too detailed and like tell everybody, but my sponsor had me doing weekly actions with every single person that was not speaking to me and my family. And I chose a day of the week, which was Saturdays. And on Saturday mornings, I belonged to a 7:30 a.m. group. So I would come home from that 7:30 a.m. group, and I would go ahead and write out these letters. I would do the third step prayer with my name in it. I would do write out the third step prayer with that person's name in it. Then I would write out the seven step prayer. I would put my specific character defects in it that were bothering me about any type of resentments that I was holding on to with this person. And then I would go ahead and write them something that was very God-centered. Like, and sometimes, you know, if I wasn't having a very spiritual week, I would just say, I pray that they find a higher power that can forgive them for the crap that they did to me. You know, I mean, that might be the best thing that I could do. But I could tell that week by week, keeping that commitment of saying, yes, Michael, I did it again this week. Yes, Michael, I did it again this week. I began to grow spiritually. And so when it came came time when we were face to face to have those in-person discussions, I was prepared because I had grown. I hadn't just sat around and done nothing. And I'm so grateful for that style or that type of sponsorship, because I need specific instructions. Anyway, thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lynn. All right, I will put up the next reading. Section 3, page 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our work. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. All right, Larry.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, that's making a skeptic. Look, I just lost my camera. You can hear me though, right?
Oh yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'll fix that while I'm talking. So, you know how it says early in the book, right? That we go back to our list because it holds the key door. And this is where it did that for me. It held the key to my future, because I thought for certain that saying sorry was enough. I thought that was going to be it. I thought that was going to do it. It's a joke, but it's true. I mean, I said so sorry so much, you'd think I was Canadian, if anyone gets Canadian humor. I said it a lot, though. I was always saying sorry. And, you know, initially, before I got a sponsor, when I would go to meetings and see those steps up on the wall, I thought that that's what this meant. I thought it meant saying sorry. Look, I even sound Canadian. Sorry. That's what I thought it meant, is that I go say sorry to people and say, hey, look, my bad. I had been doing that for quite some time already. So here is something where I can, and even with the amends, I can go make an amend. But if I go back to the same behavior that I was doing, then what's the point? What am I really doing? So for me, I have to make the amends, right? But then I have to go and I have to change my behavior. It says it in what we just read. My actions are going to be more evidence because they're going to be skeptical of me. Dude, you said sorry. I've heard it all before. Sure you are. Sure you're sorry you did that. Sure you're sorry you ruined my birthday or Christmas. Sure you're sorry you took that money. Sure you are. What I have to do is change my behavior because that's going to be what does it. And the other thing that I have to be mindful of is that not everybody's going to work on my timetable either. I'll be honest. Some of these amends did give me a little freedom. I was able to look at some people in the eyes again, especially a few folks that I owed some money. You know, I'd avoid these people and simply calling them up and letting them know, hey, I'm going to pay it back. It was almost like, you know, hiding behind corners and looking around and not going to certain places because I might run into them, et cetera, and so on. And once I started calling people and making amends or seeing them or paying money back, I got a little bit of freedom. That doesn't mean that they got that same freedom right then and there. And I got to be conscious of that, that their timetable may not be mine. It might take them some time. They might not forgive me at all. You know, talks about it. They might kick me out of their office. They might told me to F you and your fake amends, like which was told to me. And I got to be okay with that. Not too long ago, I was at work and I a coworker of mine, I kind of put him on blast in front of people. This is, I don't know how long ago this was. And what I said was completely right. Their defects may be glaring. And I said it. I told it. I told on him in front of everybody at work. And he lost it on me. And I really wanted to stick with him losing it on me. But I had to, you know, I talked about it. I called. I did what the 10th step tells us. I talked to my sponsor. But the part about this, not necessarily, I'm trying not to get into the 10th step, but the amends part. So I go and make amends to this guy. And he doubles down on how bad I was and tells me, you know, you were wrong. And he doubles down hard on me and tells me all about me and myself. And I had to eat that. I had to understand that this is what I do. I have to change my behavior. Was I right in what I said? Yes. Was I wrong about the way I went about it? Absolutely. And that's kind of the way I have to approach making amends today. That it's very hard for me. This part about their defects may be glaring. We used to, the Simple Actions used to host a Sunday meeting and they'd have speakers. And every time there'd be the question about, you know, two people are in the program, a married couple or having relationships in program. That was me. I was always asking that question because I'm in the program with married to a person who's also in the program. And sometimes their defects are glaring. And what am I going to do about that? And I remember one of the speakers says, it's the person with the most tools that has to do the work. And sometimes, depending on how spiritually fit I am, I don't got a lot of tools. And sometimes, depending on how spiritually fit she is, she don't have a lot of tools and I got to use mine. So staying out of this notion that their defects may be glaring, but kind of put them aside, that is something I have to constantly remind myself because I'm really, really good at picking out it's like a superpower. I can see them in a second. The problem is that superpower doesn't work on myself. I don't see my own. That's why it's so helpful to have a sponsor and have somebody to run these things by before I walk in there and say, hey, look, I know I yelled at you and I put you on blast in front of everybody in the meeting, but here's what you did. Never really works when I do stuff like that. Anyways, that's all I got. And I'm going to fix my camera.
Thanks, Larry. Lynn?
Yeah. Hey, everybody. I'm Lynn again. This is, you know, the reading tonight is really concentrating on family and, I like how it says that, you know, 10 or 20 years of drunkenness can make a skeptic out of anyone, you know, and one simple amends doesn't take care of it. It creates, you know, just this lifelong process. And I have two quick little family stories on this lifelong process thing going on with my, what happened with my family and my amends. And one of them was with my mother. And, you know, my mom My mom loves Alcoholics Anonymous. She loves all of my alcoholic friends. She loves the way that we laugh at things that are inappropriate. She just loves Alcoholics Anonymous. And so she gets into it and tries to have conversations and find out more information about it, because she's not the she's the only non-alcoholic in our family. And so anyway, my mom was doing something. I was about, 44 years old, somewhere around in there. My mom was doing this thing where she was calling me up at work. And it was getting like, more and more. She was getting to know some of the people at work and hanging out on the phone with them. Like, she's this bored housewife calling up and, trying to call me. And I go, Mom, nobody else is at 40 years old is having their mom call them every day at work. You're going to have to cut it back, and then finally, and she was just like, but I got something really important. You got a piece of mail today from the Alumni Association of your college. And I was like, Mom, that is not appropriate to call me at work for, so I had to have a conversation with her. I had to give her parameters about, Mom, you cannot call me during these amount. I'm too busy at work. And, it's distracting to the people who are trying to work here. And so the very next day she picks up the phone and she calls me during the designated time that I told her specifically not to call me at. And I politely reminded her that, Mom, I can't take your phone calls anymore during the day and during this time. And she tried to pick a fight with me. She got mad and she hung up on me. 2 or 3 days go by and she calls me and she said, I'm waiting for you to make that amends, because I know that every time we have a fight, you have to call me up and apologize to me so that you can stay sober. And so essentially what had happened is I trained my mom that no matter what happens, I'm always going to, call up. I'm going to make this amends. And I'm going to, I had trained her to do this. And it was so cute, because she really thought she was helping me work a program. Then the second one is that that I want to share with you is with my youngest brother, Kurt, and he had gotten very, very sick and back in 2018. And even though this is, this is a process, this whole mending relationships with our family is a process, and it goes on for many decades into my sobriety anyway. So that's why I'm sharing something that happened in 2018. But he got cancer and he was very angry about it. And he picked up on his drinking picked up. And they put him on chemo and with a lot of people, you get very sick on chemo and you cannot drink, a half a gallon of vodka every day and take chemo. You just can't. You just get sicker and sicker and sicker, which was what was happening to my brother. And he was dying. I don't know, it was not necessarily from the cancer. It was from the, combination of the toxicity of the chemo mixed with the alcohol. And, it's just really, really heartbreaking to watch somebody die that way, because he was dying of alcoholism and there was something that he could do about it. But it was really hard when they brought in hospice and, he'd brought in, all of this, extra care into the home. And, I had gone through cancer a couple of years earlier and so I kept thinking that he was going to turn to me and this was going to bring us closer. And he just became angrier and angrier at me. And, I was over there. I went over there one afternoon and he was sitting in there drinking in his living room and drinking. And he was watching the Weather Channel. And it was like the thing, like, 16 years ago, there was this tornado in Alabama, and here's the damages. I mean, it was like, you know, something you couldn't even watch on TV. What is that? It was a stupid thing on TV. And I couldn't stay interested in the TV. So I went in the next room and I was putting together a jigsaw puzzle. And I thought he might come out and join me, but he just stayed in there and kept drinking. And then he had a friend stop by to see him from work. And what happened is I overheard him talking about me to his friend. He said, "Look, my sister came over to visit me, and you can see what she's doing." And the guy, Mike, sticks his head around the corner and looks at me sitting in there working on a jigsaw puzzle. And he's like, "Hi, Lynn." And I was like, "Hi, Mike." And I was so embarrassed. I cannot believe that I have double digit sobriety. And I am just, I can't even sit in the same room with my brother. And I went home and I put pen to paper and I wrote about it. And then I called my sponsor about it and I had a discussion with her. I just told her how embarrassed I was. I said, "I can't even go and sit in the same room with him. I can't watch him drink on top of chemo. I know he's killing himself. I know he's dying." And she said, "Well, you're going to have to change your behavior." And I was like, "Is this still, do I, like, I've already made the amends to the guy." And she was like, This is still an amends. You know, you've got to be there for your brother, and because that's what your heart is telling you. And so what I would do is I would go over there and I would bring some knitting with me, and I would sit with him for 4 or 5 hours, and he would sit there and drink and watch this crap on TV. And sometimes he would just nod off, and sometimes he would talk. And I kept asking my sponsor, I go, "Is this the part where I'm supposed to be making more amends to him? Because I've already discussed most things." And she goes, "Maybe your amends to him is that you start to listen." And I didn't know that my brother had so much to say, and he had a lot of things to tell me before he died. And I didn't know I was going to get so emotional about it, because he told me about something that had happened when we were children, that he just said, "You know, you've been a really good sister to me, and you did this for me." And it was something that I had absolutely no recollection of ever doing. And he said, "Do you remember doing that?" And I just knew that God wanted me to lie to him and shake my head and say, "Yes, I remember doing that." And there were just so many important things that he had going on in his head, and everybody in his family. It took me, I can't believe that it took me so long to notice this, but everybody in his family was doing the same exact thing I was doing prior to this, is that I was ignoring him because he was drinking. And because I knew that it didn't matter if he was, you know, what he's experiencing is he's experiencing drunkenness, and that he may or may not remember this tomorrow morning. But what he did remember is that nobody in his family was talking to him, and he's dying. And he doesn't know that he's dying of alcoholism. He thinks he's dying of cancer. It doesn't make any difference. It was just, he had so much going on, and there were things that he wanted to tell me, and there were promises that he wanted me to make to him about carrying the message to his two daughters. And yesterday I went over to visit my niece, and we laid on the bed and we talked together. And when we talked about alcoholism, we talked about her father, and it was an honest talk that we hadn't had yet since he had died. And he's been dead almost 2 years. It'll be 2 years in May. And, you know, and I was just like, when I left, and this is, you know, when I left the house yesterday from talking to my youngest niece, Delaney, that, I knew I could feel the presence. I could just feel so connected to my baby brother. Like, I was just like, okay, I made him promises, and I'm keeping my promises, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And this is my amends. You know, he was asking me to do things, and I committed to doing those things, and I'm still doing those things. And I may be doing those things for the rest of my life. You know, but it's all a process. These are all dialogues. These relationships that we have with our families sometimes just get so messy. And I hope I didn't get off on too much of a tangent on this, but thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lynn. Right, I'll put up the next reading, what will probably be our last reading for the night. Section 4, page 83. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Okay, Larry?
Thanks, Mike. And I'll skip ahead just because I know that the last paragraph was the promise, the ninth step promises. I did have some amends that to people that were no longer alive. Really quickly, I stole some money from my grandfather. It's a lot of money. I bought a pound of weed with it. It'll tell you how much it was. And my grandfather used to collect these big sheets. He was a little old Japanese guy, was put in an internment camp during World War II. He hated the United States government, so he refused to put his money in banks. So he used to keep all his money on in little boxes under his bed. And I'd stolen a bunch of them. And when I got sober, I needed to pay that money back, and I needed to make amends for that. So I talked to my sponsor, and we devised a way. He got Alzheimer's as he got older. So I donated a bunch. But funny thing that happens with this process of the steps, I'm taking somebody else through the steps, and they're doing their fifth step with, and they talk about stealing some money from a parent, but they blame somebody else. And I'd forgot the other part of that story is that my parents thought my brother stole that money, but it was me. And it was a huge thing in my family. And I had totally forgot about that part of the story. And I was like, oh my God, I need to call my sponsor. And, I talked to Lynn, was one of the people I talked to about this, about how do I make amends. My brother was in prison at the time, and Lynn had referenced the story in this chapter about the guy who stands up in front of everybody, and he basically says what he did to make his reputation whole. That's what he did, and that's what I did. I went to my mother and I told her what I did. Not so much about my brother to him, but I also told my mother that you all thought it was my brother and it was me. And I could go into the details of what happened. I just want to say this real quick because I know we're running out of time and I want to give Lynn some time to speak about the ninth step promises. For the longest time, as they say them in a lot of meetings, some meetings refer to them as the promises. I know now there's promises at every step, but those ninth step promises, I always thought they were the promises. I thought if you go to some AA meetings, you get the promises, they come true. And I went to a lot of AA meetings and those ninth step promises weren't coming true. I've heard David say it. I've heard a few people say it about, I can read those promises and think about when I drank and used drugs and they did all those things for me, right? I didn't care about my past. I didn't care about money. I didn't care. I had no fear. I was fearless when I drank and used drugs, right? All those nights that promises could easily apply to my drinking and drug use. There is no way those things are coming true without any of that. And then I take these nights that promises. I start paying some bills. I owe the IRS 50 grand. Guess what? I don't have fear of economic insecurity because now I'm on a payment plan. I'm not fearful of going around certain people because I've called them up and said, hey, I did this. I started owning some of these things. All those promises started to come true before I was halfway done with my amends. The ninth step promise. They're at the ninth step. So this whole time, I'd been in AA for 2.5 years, never opening the big book, never getting a sponsor, never taking a single step. I, in a few short months, take the steps. And after all that 2 years of sitting around in AA, in just a few short months, those ninth step promises start to come true for me. That's when the magic happened for me, is at the ninth step, the spiritual experience started to occur. And every amends was a little spiritual experience. And by the 12th step, I had the spiritual. It was a result of the culmination of the steps. The ninth step is when the spiritual experience started. It's the tingle. It's the divine spark. It's the God moment. I don't know what you want to call it, but I started to feel it. I talked to my friend Hank about this last week because they were talking about amends at a meeting I go to, principles. And we were talking about that tingle you get after making amends. I started to get it during this step. And this is a guy who walked in the door as an atheist. And I started to feel oneness with something that I choose to call God today. And it's because of these ninth steps. So that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Larry. All right, Lynn.
I apologize for going on too long. I'm just going to keep this very short. And, you know, the wrongs that I can never fully right is, you know, the damage that I did to my Al-Anon mother. And, you know, I would call her in blackouts and never remember what I would say and what I'd said. And, you know, just all of these horrible, horrific things. And, you know, today, my relationship has totally changed with my mother. She has Alzheimer's, dementia. And, you know, I, since all of my brothers have died, I'm her primary caretaker. I'm her person. I'm her people. And, you know, there's sometimes when I just don't feel very spiritually fit, and she has said the same thing to me like 10 or 15 times. And I just remind myself, I go, this is part of my amends process. She listened to my crap for so long and she stood by me. And the thing is that I'm never, ever going to be able to fully write that. One year, I think it was at my 8-year birthday, she showed up and gave me my medallion and she was just so proud of me. But she just stood there and she goes, I just didn't know what else to do for my daughter. And she just started crying in full of this room full of 80 people when I was picking up my medallion. And she goes, and you guys fixed her. And, you know, it's like I always just keep that in the back of my head. I'm just like going, you know what, Mom? I don't take that tone of voice that I save for only family members that irritate me, you know, that tone of voice. I don't take that tone with her. And I haven't done that for many years now. I just go, you know what, Mom? The answer is yes, you know, or the answer is. And I just don't go, you know what? This is the 15th time you just asked me the same thing, you know? And the thing is that I say it with love and compassion, and I feel privileged to be a part of her life and be a part of taking care of her today. Anyway, that's an entire psychic change for me. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. All right. Thank you both for sharing. Great meeting tonight. All right. The seventh tradition. David, if you'd be so kind to put up the seventh tradition QR code. And now let me minimize that screen for me because it has that same effect that we've talked about on my end. Shame on me. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While the contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group or central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements? Larry, go ahead.
Hey, Larry, alcoholic. If you're looking for a meeting New Year's Eve, I know there's going to be a bunch. My home group, Candlelight. We are going to have like a little pre-meeting thing at 7. There might be some food. We do practice social distancing. We do wear masks in that meeting. So that's Friday at 7. We'll start at 8 o'clock. There'll be a speaker. That is this Friday. My cat's going off. 1301 Kali Candlelight. If you want more info, just let me know after the meeting. All right. Thanks.
All right. Great. Thank you, Larry. All right. That was the only hand I saw raised. So we'll move on. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. And home group members, you know the deal. Please raise your hand. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any of us, or you can email info@simpleactions.net. And in closing, and we'll unmute everybody after the Lord's Prayer or right before the Lord's Prayer, and we'll thank the panel after we finish the Lord's Prayer and wrap up this meeting. But again, thank you, Lynn, and thank you, Larry, both for your sharing this evening. And David, would you be willing to read a vision for you? I'm hoping you will. I'm assuming the answer is yes. You are the man.
Love to. Alcoholic David. Thank you. Thank you, Lynn and Larry. You guys are all heart. I love you both. This is from the Big Book, page 164, A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Great. Thank you, David. All right. And we'll go ahead and close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. And David, if are you unmuting everybody so we can have a discombobulated, chaotic chorus?
Everyone is free to unmute themselves as they see fit.
All right. Fantastic. All right. The Lord's Prayer. Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven.
Hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. On earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread,
and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom,
the power, and the glory,
forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen.
Woohoo! You guys are great.